As we continue our series on different books or genres of Holocaust literature, we're going to focus on a specific book and a genre today that relates to spiritual and religious life, resistance, experiences in the Holocaust, which is part of a broader genre that we'll talk about a little bit. But I want to give two introductory notes before we address this topic. The first, and this is a theme that we're going to come back to, is that in Jewish life and Jewish learning, the Torah, this spiritual divine guidebook, is a living Torah, is a living, breathing, organic entity. That is what Torah is. And for that reason, in our tradition, when Moses stood at Sinai, he received two distinct gifts. One was what we call Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah. And the second one, what's that? Exactly, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition. So on the one hand, he was given a written text. On the other hand, he was given tools, intellectual, cognitive tools of how to interpret that text, how to read between the lines, logical inferences, analysis. According to most opinions, Moses was not given every interpretation that would ever be, you know, initiated or thought of, but he was given all the rules. And those rules are the same rules that were applied throughout the generations. So, for example, how to compare different topics. If you see one halacha, one law, in one context, can you compare it to a different context to serve as a model? This whole world of learning is part of the oral tradition. So there was a written text that was given, and then there was an oral tradition, which includes explanations. So, for example, it never says anywhere in the Chumash what fruit you're supposed to take when you take the four species. It says pre-Eitz Hadar. So the Talmud has a tradition. We have a tradition that that fruit is an esrog. It doesn't say it in the Chumash. That's not in the Torah Shebichsav, in the written text. It's in the oral tradition. And the same for many, many other aspects of Jewish learning. There's the written tradition and the oral tradition. So within this realm of Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, there are certain things that Maimonides describes were never subject to argument, ever. No one ever thought that the fruit that you're supposed to take on Sukkot is a plum. There was never any debate about that. Where are there debates? There are debates in analysis, in matters. So we said, for example, before about comparing two issues to each other. So they're not debates about a Pirushim HaMekubalim, traditional interpretations. They're arguments about how to compare. And that will depend, the Rambam discusses, and today's not the topic to talk about this, but a lot of times it will talk about, it will devolve or evolve based on the type of analysis, the legal skills that you have or the orientation that you have to a particular issue. So, for example, Shammai and Hillel, they had different ways of analyzing the same issue, but you can analyze it from two different perspectives, and that's going to cause there were different areas of machlokas. So there is Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, and there is Torah Shebaal Peh. So one question that has been addressed over many generations is, why was it that God needed to split this in half? Why didn't he give us one Torah? And that's it. Why did he have to give us Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebaal Peh, the written Torah and the oral Torah? So one answer, there are many answers to this question, but one answer is that it would be impossible to include all information that would ever be needed to follow the divine plan for the rest of the generations, for hundreds and thousands of years, in one book. And therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam, in his divine wisdom, God decided, I'm going to give you the text, I'm going to give you traditions and methods of interpretation, and then you're going to apply it in every generation. So, they didn't have, in the context of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Moses in the desert, they didn't have automobiles, they didn't have cars. But you could take the principles that were given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai and apply them to how you navigate the world of Shabbos, for example, with an automobile. They didn't have in vitro fertilization, but you use your powers of comparison, the different tools that the rabbis were given to understand. So this is the first element, that there is a world of Torah which is constantly evolving. It's constantly innovating within a fixed tradition, because now you have new circumstances that never appeared in the history of the world. You have artificial intelligence questions that never appeared before, but if you're a programmer in some high-tech startup company somewhere and you have to decide what the algorithm should be if this self-driving car has to choose between staying on the road and hitting a pedestrian or going off the road and running into a bus stop, some human being is thinking about that algorithm that was never dealt with at Moses at Sinai. But lots of other things were, and we're going to extrapolate from there. That's number one to know. Number two is that there is a notion, a halachic category, a concept called masorah, which means tradition. This tradition relates both to the written text and it relates to the oral tradition, the Torah Shebichsav and the Torah Shebaal Peh. So, for example, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses was given a book. That book is passed down many generations. I forget how many words there are in the Chumash. I don't know, there are like 80,000 words, I think, or 400,000 letters, something like that. That has a masorah, a tradition. There are only, I think, 11 or 12 discrepancies in all of those hundreds of thousands of letters. Only about 11 discrepancies. I think 11 out of those 12 are vavs, which already in Talmudic times there was questions about whether that matters or doesn't matter. And then there's one instance where there is a hey or an aleph, which is a question. But if you think about how many years it's been, we left Egypt in the year 2448. That's when we got the Torah. And we're here in the year 5783. That's an awful long time to have only 11 or 12 minor discrepancies. If somebody tells you that this Torah scroll that you open in your synagogue, exactly the same one as they got at Moses at Sinai, they may not be precise, because there may be one vav that's missing. But you roll out that entire scroll, that's the extent of it. So that's one tradition. But of course there's the tradition, which is even more important, in the oral, and this is kind of what you alluded to before, about the teacher and the student, and how you pass along the tradition of knowledge. Also, the method of analysis, all of those things go into this concept called masorah, which is why it's very significant that when the Rambam, when Maimonides, I'm going to just get the door, please, for Lori, she's locked out. When Maimonides introduces his book, the Rambam, he lived in the 12th century, the Rambam wrote a book on all of Jewish law, everything. He said, all you need in your library is a Bible, a Tanakh, and my book, and you got it all covered. The first thing he does then is, he tells you, there's an extra copy here, the Rambam tells you, I'm going to give you the names of the rabbis, all the way from Moses till the conclusion of the Talmud with Rav Ashi. Because you have to know that this is an unbroken chain of tradition, and that the people, the men who occupy those chairs, it's like a long line of chairs, 40 chairs all in a row, the people who occupy those chairs, they have a significant role, a status of being the arbiters, the stewards of this knowledge, this information from one generation to the next, all the way till they got to the conclusion of the Talmud, and then further. Okay. But just, yeah, go ahead.
How many thousands of years, the way that we have the Torah, because I don't, when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, the writing is different.
Good. So this is another topic for another time, but there were two different traditional scripts. There used to be what was called Ksav Ivri, which I guess you could call today more like stick script. Stick script, kind of, like very, very you call it primitive, I guess, in a certain sense. Ancient. And then there's called Ashuri, which is more like block print, which is what you find in a Sefer Torah, and that was shifted in the time of Ezra in the Second Temple period from Ksav Ivri to Ksav Ashuri. There's a lot of discussion about that. But the thing that I want to mention here specifically is that in the tradition, especially when it comes to Torah Shebaal Peh, there is a relationship between a teacher and a student. Moses received the Torah at Sinai. That's what we say in the beginning of Ethics of the Fathers. He passed it on to Yoshua. And the Maimonides, the Rambam, gives us exactly the names of these people because they had an interaction. They had a back and forth. So much so that Moshe is referred to Moshe, the teacher. And when he passed away, the people came to Yoshua. They said to him, okay, so now you're our teacher because you received from Moshe. So you have to pass it on to the next person. So these two elements of the history and the development of Torah are important for understanding our topic today. That this Torah that we have today, that we learn, that we are passing on to future generations, is a living Masorah. It's a living tradition. It's a living life. It's not some archaic scroll that existed sometime in the past. It is alive, and it's being passed down from one generation to next generation, and particularly in the world of the oral tradition. That's where the vibrancy is found most. It's the interaction between the Rebbe and the Talmud, the teacher and the student, which is why Rav Soloveitchik explained, and if we had more time, maybe I'll send you the link afterwards. He described that he was, you know, he was born in 1903. When he's giving his shiurim to his students in 1970s, he feels he's old. He's in the autumn of his life. He's falling apart physically. He's exhausted. He walks into the room and he feels young. Not only that, he says he feels young, and the door opens, and who walks in? Rabbeinu Tam, one of the great rabbis from the 12th century, and someone from the 15th century. It's what he calls a symposium of generations. Because this unbroken chain means that when we're learning a topic today, in 2022, in the Holocaust Museum in Skokie, we're really connecting to a tradition of rabbis who are at the same table. You maybe have to use a little imagination. You have to open your mind to see what Rav Soloveitchik saw. But Rav Oshrier, we're going to focus on today. He's sitting right here. And he's going to quote from the Rambam, who's sitting right here. It's one symposium of generations. It's a living experience. Not just how people follow the halacha, but in terms of the learning of the halacha. So that brings us to the particular area of Jewish learning which we're focusing on today. It's a specific genre, and that is called Shailos and Tshuvos. She'elot u'tshuvot. Questions and answers. Also known as the responsa literature. Exactly. Because if we put these things together, we say, okay, we had a written Torah that gives us the skeleton, the bones, the divine structure. Then you have the oral Torah, which fills in the gaps, and that's living from generation to generation. And then you have the tradition of the teachers and the students. So what happens when you have a new issue that comes to the fore? We tap into the oral tradition, and we look to our teachers, and we write a question. Now you'll email it, you'll text it, you'll WhatsApp note it. But in the old days, you would either ask it in person, or you would send a letter. And you would say, well, I have this circumstance. I have a conflict. I have two values that are conflicting with each other. How do we utilize the tools that we have, the tradition that we have, to resolve this challenge, this conflict, which is usually what a Shaila is about. If it's already written down in the Torah itself, or if it's written down in the Code of Jewish Law in the Shulchan Aruch in the 1500s, no one needs to ask about it. The question is, well, what about a new circumstance that I never heard of before? So this is where the world opens up of Jewish learning in what we call Shailos and Tshuvos, She'elot u'Tshuvot, responsa. Because it didn't just become, I have a Shaila for you and you give me the answer. Many, over thousands of years already, hundreds of thousands of Tshuvos, many great rabbis kept records. They kept records of these Shailos and Tshuvos, these questions and answers. And they become precedent for Jewish law. One of the interesting, and we're not going to talk about this so much today, but one of the interesting aspects of the learning of Shailos and Tshuvos is that some rabbis use these letters as actually a medium for conveying their original insights. Because there are different ways to write Tshuvos. Someone could ask you a Shaila, I have this medical halachic issue. What do I do in such and such a case? So you can write back to them, do this. That's one style. But you could write your tshuva and start, well, it says in the Chumash, in the Torah, like this. Then it says in the Gemara like this. Then there's an argument between the Rambam in the 13th century, the Maimonides, and the Nachmanides in the next century. And you go and trace the history. And then you give your own analysis. That actually now opens up the Jewish learning a lot more. So now you get a window into how someone thought about this issue. So not only do you get the rule, but over time, and this is a meta issue which is beyond the scope of our discussion today, but it's interesting to note that in different places and different times, different rabbis have different styles of writing these tshuvas. Some of them are much more succinct, and it's just about just the facts, ma'am. And some of them are much more lengthy, and they're a vehicle for analysis. And this goes on until this very day. One of the interesting Jewish law developments that emerged over COVID was in the area of she'elos and tshuvos, questions and answers. Because now you had questions, some of which had never been dealt with before, some of which had, and that's what the rabbinic authorities, the great Talmudic and halachic giants of every generation, including our own, they're going to use all of those precedents. Some of those precedents comes from she'elot u'tshuvot, but some of them are new. Can you deputize someone to sell your chametz by email? Well, yes. The noted Yehuda, Rabbi Cheskel Landau in Prague in the 17th century, he never heard of email, I guarantee you, right? Never heard of email. Never did. But how do you deal with mechiras chametz in a pandemic when usually the rabbi will sell the chametz on behalf of all the community members? By the way, the rabbi never buys your chametz. He never buys your chametz. He only is deputized. I don't want your chametz. No rabbis want your chametz. But they are acting as your agent. Well, Rabbi Reis, the Abbez of the CRC, had to figure out during the pandemic when we were in lockdown on Pesach, how do you sell the chametz to the non-Jew if you can't sit in the same room and shake his hand? How do you deal with that? What? Well, how does the rabbi make the transaction? The non-Jew is not there. Usually, when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, the rabbi sits down at the table. The non-Jew, what's that?
Hazmat suits, no.
So this is a question. He had to leave something at the door. The non-Jew is going to pick it up. He stands inside the door, outside the door. All kinds of questions comes up. Fast, all kinds of questions. What about many of us made Pesach for the first time? Mm-hmm. And the mikveh was closed for kalim, for vessels. So how do you deal with buying all these Pesach utensils? And so I went to Lake Michigan, but not everybody is up for that. You know, not everybody's up for that. It's the same thing for the mikvah and Erev Yom Kippur. Depending on how adventurous you are, that's, you know what I'm saying, whatever. There are ways, in different halachic circumstances, there are ways to do what needs to be done. But anyway.
Not too many bodies of water in the desert.
So these are all, it's alive. It's alive. This is a Torah Chaim. So in every generation, people are dealing with these things all the time. All the time. She'elos and tshuvos. Questions and answers. So this is the world. If you want a great research on this, there is an excellent work. You know, we should take the joke. Can you pass some more plates down for everybody who got to get the birthday cake? There was a reform rabbi. He was a great scholar. It's from Jewel. I bought it.
No.
It's kosher.
Oh,
the plate is not kosher. But the happy birthday goes to Shail. Ad me'ev ha'esrim in good health. So this reform rabbi, his name was Solomon Freehoff. He was an expert in the responsa literature. Fantastic. So if you want to learn more about this issue, you got to get this book. Is called The Responsa Literature. It's not the most innovative title. You can remember it very easily. He also has a book called A Treasury of Responsa. And what he does is he selects responsa over the generations and he analyzes what the questions are, what the style is, how they were being answered. So let's say there is a particular set of responsa that are authored in the 14th century in Spain. Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, the Rashba, one of the most important rabbinic figures of that time, he wrote, I don't think, maybe 1,000 responsa, 1,000. So what was the Rashba writing about? Who was he writing to? What was he writing? Why was he answering this? And then you go further and further. This is like a whole world. We could do a whole year and then some of this study of the responsa literature. So with that background, we can appreciate the fact now that in the context of a living Torah, of the Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral tradition, and the transmission of this from one teacher to the next, which is alive and adapting and relating to every circumstance, you can imagine that in the Holocaust, there were many she'elos and tshuvos. Many questions and answers. And you can learn many things from these shilos and tshuvos. So one thing which you can learn Jewish law. What to do in a case of emergency circumstances. So what happens if, Rachmana Litzlan lo aleinu, there is a war in Ukraine and there's a problem of getting grain exported. There's a problem of food shortages. So what happens when you have a shaila that it's coming Pesach, like it was this year, and there were Jews who had limited food access? There was even a fear, thank God it never materialized, there was a fear, one of the discussions among Rabbanim before Pesach of COVID that year, whatever year that was, 20, it's all one long year.
2020.
Exactly. 2020 was, what happens if there's a food shortage? I mean, remember we did crazy things at that time? Like, we went, the Chum and I went with gloves to the Jewel in Highland Park to buy stuff for Pesach, and we wiped it all down in the garage. No one knew anything. Remember in those days?
Yeah.
It was crazy times. It was total craziness, right? Well, what about if there's a food shortage in Ukraine and people said, we can't get matzah, we can't get enough kashal Pesach wheat, can we eat kidneys? Can you eat legumes? So one of the places to look, if you want to think about eating legumes, is actually in a tshuva that we're going to see today, in the Mimamakim. Because guess what? In the ghetto, they didn't have enough matzah, like they didn't have enough anything. So, number one, learning the tshuvas that emerged from the Holocaust gives you insight into halacha. Second element, something that you can learn from these tshuvas, from these responses, not just Jewish law, you also learn history. Now, this is a double-edged sword. In one of the discussions here that Freehoff has in this book, The Response to Literature, he points out that using responsa as a source of literature has limitations. Because he points out, many of the most important events never found their way into this literature. Over history, not every event is going to appear in a tshuva, in a responsa. No questions happen to have been asked of the leading rabbis involving those events, or if they were asked, neither question nor answer was preserved. Also, certain literary habits in certain periods of responsa literature have made them a very poor historical source. For example, the considerable responsa literature of the Gaonim has the characteristic, or at least in our present transcript of it, of omitting the name and the place of almost every inquisitor. This is unfortunate for the writers of Jewish history. Right, so you don't know who's asking, who's answering, as opposed to, let's say, a modern giant of rabbinic responsa, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So Rav Moshe is living most of his life in the Lower East Side. He came from a small town in Russia. He's often going to give you not just the date of the responsa, but the name of the questioner and the place that they're asking. So it gives you some context. But even that is somewhat limited because you don't know the personal circumstance of that individual. But it's still useful for understanding some element. On the other hand, Solomon Freehoff points out, there is one reason why the response are an exceptionally good source of historical information. The questions that come up in this literature were submitted for legal decision. It was necessary, therefore, for their facts to be precise and their circumstances sharply delineated. Very often, in times of persecution, for example, when a decision had to be made whether a man was presumed dead or not, which in the Holocaust is very significant and very prominent, the circumstances of the riot or attack, which, think about that, why are these questions emerging? Because people disappeared in pogroms. Upon a certain community were carefully looked into. If therefore there is any record at all in the response of an event of this nature, it can be trusted as factual and need never fall under the suspicion of being literary embellishment, forgivably exaggerated under the stress of the emotions of some orphaned refugee. They're going to be extremely precise in answering these shilas. This is not literary hyperbole. These are legal questions that need to be dealt with, and the Gemara has an expression for this. Kefi ra'os einei hadayan, according to the vision, whatever the arbiter of this, the judge of this circumstance, whatever they see. So it doesn't mean this is necessarily the fact, taking in all the considerations that they weren't aware of at that time, but it's the facts to the extent that they saw them at that moment. So, for example, what to do, lo aleinu, and we're going to just a few of these, but they're very, very difficult, as you can imagine. This is just, Shaila comes to a rabbi in Lodz, what to do with the talisim, or the tefillin, of people that were deported, and the talis is sitting in the shul. So they're going to answer that question based on the information that they have about what's happening to people who are being deported from Lodz at that given time. But it's not emotionally exaggerated. It's whatever they see, that's how they're going to rule. So there are multiple sources of tshuva literature from the Holocaust. We've mentioned once in the past the Shilas and Tshuvas Mikachi Hashem from the Weitzner Rav from here in Chicago. But today, with this very, very long preamble, we're going to focus just on one, the Shilas and Tshuvas Mimamakim. So if you had a chance at the beginning to read the brief biography which is in this New York Times obituary, you could take a look at it. You could read it later. We'll reference it briefly. You have plenty of time to read it. The author of this, Tshuvas Mimamakim, dies in 2003 at the age of 89. The great rabbinic light of the Holocaust, Rav Ephraim Oshri, Zecher Tzadok Levracha. Rav Oshri was a prominent, young, up-and-coming rabbinic personality in Kovna in June of 1941. What happens in June of 1941 in Kovno? Kovno is the second largest city in Lithuania. It's second in terms of prominence to Vilna. It's not far from another town nearby called Slobodka, which had a famous yeshiva where he was very connected. The Germans rolled in June, on June 23rd, 1941. And during the next several months, on scraps of paper, Rav Oshri wrote down, he noted the questions, the shilas that were asked to him. And then, after the war, he was able to find his way back to Kovno, to the place where he had hidden these paper scraps, unearth them, and then develop them into a formal question and answer with traditional rabbinic sources, because when he was on the run in Kovno, he didn't have the benefit of a library. He was answering these questions from memory from people who knocked on his door. So these are the actual questions that he got, which are written down contemporaneously, not post facto. He wrote them down b'shas ma'isa at the moment. He came back to them later and then published them. This, what you're looking at, if you turn your pages to page 4. This is what we call the Sharblot in Yiddish. This is the title page, Sefer She'elos U'Tshuvos Mimamakim. When is it published? Bottom of the Sharblot, Shnas Tuf Shin Yud Tes Lefi Mispar Katan. What year is that? Anybody know? Tuf Shin Yud Tes, any guesses? 1959. So it's interesting to think how long it took him to publish these tshuvas. That's interesting. Doesn't publish until 1959, yes?
What this reminds me, what he did by writing it in the scraps and hiding them, reminds me of
You know, the archetypes of...
Exactly. Very similar.
I mean, it's a different...
different genre, same purpose. Exactly. Exactly. That this should be memorialized, that somebody should know. Which is going to bring us to the third thing that you can learn from Tshuvas, which is, of course, going to be our takeaway today, which is to glean the sparks of inspiration. So you can learn halacha from Tshuvas, you can learn history from Tshuvas, but really we're going to learn inspiration. Yeah, doctor.
You have to assume that there are other rabbis who are answering Tshuvas at the same time. What if the two rabbis disagree?
So this is a good question in general. What happens when you have people with different opinions? Mm-hmm. So usually, if you ask a question from one rabbinic tradition, there's no shopping around. This is the Gemara in Nida. You ask a person, they give you the answer, that's the answer that you go with. Sometimes somebody will take two opinions and then present them and discuss them and share them. So you'll have two people who either will decide among themselves or we'll have to come and solve that later, looking at the two, and which is why response in literature is very helpful, especially when it's not just a yes-no answer. So let's say, even today, you'll have a question. I'll give you a simple question. How to deal with the recitation of brachos in a restroom which has modern-day plumbing? The Talmud says that when a person is in a place that's unclean, we should not recite a blessing or the name of God. It's not respectful. So the Gemara says that even a Beis Hakise, a restroom, even if there's nothing foul in there at the moment, it's not a place to recite blessings. But what if you have modern plumbing and nothing stays in the bathroom? It immediately gets flushed out. Does that room have the halachic status of a bathroom? That would be an example of a modern question. So it could be that maybe in the Lower East Side, Rav Moshe Feinstein gave one answer to such a question. And in Israel, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, of blessed memory, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, he gave a different answer. So today, you'll look at those tshuvas and you'll compare them. And you'll say, which one is more compelling? Which one seems to be the right answer based on...
Each individual decides for himself?
Yes. So if you are qualified to answer these questions, which is somebody who's definitely higher than my pay grade and my knowledge of learning, but I have teachers and mentors. So let's say during COVID, one of the most senior Torah authorities in America is Rav Herschel Schechter, Shlita. He's my Rebbe. He was the person who married Nechama and me. So he gets the bulk of the difficult, most difficult questions. He's one of the most senior rabbinic authorities living today. So during COVID, he got and published, wrote many of these things. So students, guys my age, collected them, put them together so that people would be able to access them and look at them. So Rav Schechter would look at tshuvas in different periods and different precedents and rule based on those precedents. So now, this is Rav Oshri's collection of tshuvas. You see where it's put, 1959. It's printed in New York. He survives the war. He goes for a brief period of time to Canada, but the bulk of his life is in New York. He reestablishes his wife and children were gone during the war, but he remarries, and it's a whole new family. It's many children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, thank God. So who is this? Ephraim ben La'adoni Avi, Mori v'Rabbi Harav, Dov Zal Oshri. Rav, he's the rabbi of the Beis Medrash HaGadol, this is the name of his shul, in New York. So he's writing in New York, he's publishing these tshuvas. So I'm going to give you a handful of tshuvas, but before we do that, I want to read with you the introduction that he wrote to this book. This is a man who lost his family, who lost his community. He lost everything. He rebuilds, he comes to America, and now he's going to publish the responsa from the war, which later become, by the way, five volumes. Five volumes. This is just Chelek Aleph, portion one. He has five volumes of tshuvas. So how does he write? Mima Makim. I'm on page 5. We'll go through it. There actually is a translation of this. It was a selection of these published by, I think, Tav in the 80s or 90s, called something or other. You could Google it, but I forget the name of it. I don't have it, and I think it's out of print. So we're going to go with the Hebrew.
That's
so
very accessible.
That, exactly. I don't know the name, and it's not available, so we'll just go with the Hebrew. All right? This is what we've got. Mimamakim. What does the word mimamakim mean?
From the depths.
That's right, from the depths. So he quotes a verse in Psalms and Tehillim, Mimamakim, from the depths, Kurasicho Hashem, I've called out to you, God. Bimistarim Tifkenafshi, in the hidden places, my soul cries. This is paraphrasing a verse which is taken later in the Talmud in Maseches Chagiga about the weeping of Hashem, about divine weeping, about the suffering of Jews. Al Am Hashem, on the nation of God, Hashem Nafal Bacharev, that they fell by the sword, Hashmed, a destruction, Vakilayon, absolute annihilation. Sha'ah, at a time, Shenimsar Biyad Sar, at a time that we were given over to the hand of an enemy. Sheparas Yado al Machmade Yisrael. What's a Yad? Paras Yado, that had his stretched out hand, al Machmade Yisrael. This is a biblical reference to the book of, any guesses what book he would be paraphrasing in this phrase? Yada, Pasuk says, Yada Paras Sar al Kol Machmadeha. His hand was outstretched against all of his treasures. Which book would Rav Oshri be paraphrasing in this? What book do you think? Yes. That's right. It's a pasuk in Eicha, Lamentations, the book of Eicha. What's the feel, the evocation? When do we read Eicha? That's right. So that's the feeling. Yodo parasor, it's a play on words. He says, if you're reading this and you know rabbinic literature, you're going to get what I'm trying to convey to you, the feeling. This is a pasuk in Eicha that he's using, prefiguring that pasuk to relate to the experience that he had at the hands of the Nazis. Harag velo chamal, they killed, they had no compassion. Nar vezakein, children and elderly. He describes elsewhere, not in this discussion, elsewhere what he saw, the brutality, not just of the Germans, but also Lithuanians. They took one of the elders in the community, they opened it, a Talmud, they put the head down and they sawed it off. He describes that he saw it with his own eyes. He saw what he knew from people that described the massacres. So he's trying to convey the feeling. Children, babies with their mothers. Line number four. I give you numbers so at least you can follow easier in the Hebrew. Shalish me'amenu, a third of our people, nisfa, was gathered up. Below lolo es umivsere tzoraso, and the citadels of Torah huskuru, they were shut. The murders and all types of horrible things, so to speak. And where in line number five, b'misrafos eish, in misrafos eish, what does that mean? Pyres of fire, people who were burned, the te'e gaz, gas chambers. Chas v'shalom, ovad nitzchonu v'tochaltenu me'ashem. Line number seven, next paragraph. Shavas mesos libi. Again, a piece from Lamentations. He's using that phrase. Shavas, it was ceased. Mesos libi, the gladness of my heart. I have no happiness. Me'oz ra'ishi es ami ani ami. When I saw the people of my nation, they were taken out to be killed, line number eight, ka'olos tamimos, like pure sacrifices. They said Hashem Echad, and they fulfilled the dictum of the rabbis, line number 10, b'chol nafshecha. They connected to God, even when, it's like it says in the Shema, when they take away everything, even you person has to give up their whole life, he says, I saw this. And then he says, I cannot forget this. I can't forget it from that moment. Me'az lo uchal shechoach, I can't forget the fright, the fear that I saw with my eyes, I can't forget it. Gam achshav, even now, when I'm not facing that, I'm still caught with the fright that I experienced by being in the ghetto. The things that I saw. Yiv'asuni on line 12. I'm shaking from the tsaras, the horrible things that I saw. Hayogon ashod v'ashever. And I call out to God from this. Line 16. Now he gives you the background that we told you before. Ubaisahi at that time, Vani Begeha Rega, I was in the valley of death, Begeto Kovno. I was in the Kovno ghetto. Line 16. Milvad Shahisi Ach Litsaras Achai Ba'avoras Hakfia. Not only did I have to be subjected to slave labor with my brethren, Sha'avadi ti itam biyachad, we work together. Zachisi, I merited gam liyos mi matzdike harabim, from those who help the community. Ubesochen, within the darkness, I continued, line number 19, laharbitz Torah, to teach Torah, in my little base medrash that was called Abba Yechezkel's Klois. That was the name. He gives you the name. My little shul was called Abba Yechezkel's Klois, and I was still teaching Torah there. I taught Torah in the, and then he gives you all the names. Let's go, that's not so important for us. Go to the next page, number 6. And he says, at that time, go to line number 6. Go to line 6, first line of the next paragraph. We've mentioned the name of this man before. At that time, Hagon Rav Avram Kahana Shapira, line 7, who was the aged rabbi of Kovna, was still living. So we talked about at the beginning the Masorah, the tradition from parents to students. So here you have a young man in his 20s, and the Kovna Rav Avram Dovber Kahana Shapira, that was his name, he was still living. So there was this connection of the generations. He was known as the Dvar Avram. That was the title of his responsa. His responsa was published before the war. Rav Avram Kahana, so it's called Dvar Avram, the word of Avram. So he, Rav Oshri, says, I was still there when, even though he was ill, the Kovna Rav died. He was not killed by the Nazis. He was probably killed by the grief. But he was still living just then at the beginning of the war. Adayin Bechayim, line 7. He was still alive, even though he was sick and lying in bed. Rabim, line number 8, Rabim Haponim Olav Levakish Tormi Piu, people asked them many different questions. And many of these questions were life and death questions. And look at what he says on line number 12. Umikavan, line 12 in the middle. Page 6, line 12. Mikavan since. Shehayisi says, I was. Mi boy beso tomid mamish. I used to come to the house of Rav Avram all the time. The Dvar Avram says, Rav Ashri, I was privileged to be one of the people who used to come to his house. I was there. This is what we call Shimush Talmidei Chachamim. It's not just learning from a book, but learning from living example. That there is a rabbi and you come spend time with him. I'll mention his name, Shabin Aliyah, for his neshama, Rav Schwartz, Zecher Tzadok Levracha, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz. So you know, he was one of the great rabbinic decisors of the generation. So rabbis would call him with shilas. So when we first moved to Chicago, I was a little shy and I was a little bit intimidated. But after a couple of years, you know, I'm really not so shy. So I don't have too many qualms about too many things. So I finally mustered up the guts to ask him if I could come and have what's called shimush experience with him. This was a man in his 80s who was getting questions from all around the country and all around the world. So he gave me one of the greatest gifts of my life. I used to come every week for an hour, and he had kept a yellow notepad, and he wrote down all the questions that people sent him, especially rabbis, and he kept them from week to week. And he would review them with me, what the question was, what the circumstances were, and what he answered. The only thing that I regret now is that at the time, I didn't do an audio recording. I brought a paper and I wrote down notes, but he was talking and I was writing, and like, now when I look back at the notes, it's not like publishable. It's not something that I can even recall all the details. But that was the most amazing experience. That's real Shimush Talmidei Chachamim. And he got questions that were some very, very difficult questions, very weighty, life and death questions, emotional health questions, questions about abortion and gender changes, all kinds of things that are omen ala perek mamish. These are real difficult questions right now. He got them already, when was that? Probably 8 years ago when he was starting to get these kinds of questions. So Rav Oshri, Zichron Levracha, he said, I was there in the house. I was there when people would come and go from Rav Avram's Dov Ber Kahana, when they came to the Kovna Rav with life and death questions. He says, I was there. I belonged in the house. So I was there all the time. Haya mevakish mimeni. The Kovna Rav was lying ill in his bed. And he said he would ask me, can you look into this and tell me, what do you think? Lahavdil elef alfei havdalos. It's like a Supreme Court justice has a law clerk. So the Kovner Rav is one of the greatest luminaries of the generation, especially after the death of Rav Chaim Moshe Grzesinski. And he's ill, and he says, I can't get up to get a Gemara from here, from there. This is what I remember. Look it up. Tell me, what did you find? So Rav Ashi would come back and says, I found this. And Rav Dov Ber Kahana would say, okay, so this is Psak. This is what it's going to be. This is what you're seeing. Unbelievable. And he says, because of this, I got collected many different questions that came up at that time. V'kach etzdabru etzli, line 14, al shelos mishelos shonos, all different kinds of questions that came up. Ha'ofyanos lezman hamyuchad, which were specific and ofyani.
Representing.
Yes, they are representing the ofyani, they are characteristic of the time. Meaning, these shilas are the kinds of things people were dealing with in Kovna, in Vilna, in Slobodka, all these Lithuanian towns. And this is such a rich place of Jewish history. We once mentioned, remember we talked about Vilna, we mentioned the Hermann Kruck Diaries? It was called the Jerusalem of Lita. Lita was like a bastion of Jewish observance and learning. So this is like, you're at the epicenter of halachic analysis. And he says, I got all these different questions, all these different kinds. Now go to line 20. Vehine achshav, now. Ka'avor, passing 15 years since I wrote these things. Avarti ben abisarim. I went through the pieces. I've gone through the pieces. I wonder why it took him 15 years. I wonder. But for some reason, it took him 15 years to come back to analyze it from a halachic standpoint, to publish it. Pisos haniyar, the pieces of paper, shazma nasan behem es shina v'hischel lasas behem shemos, they're starting to erode. The paper's starting to fall apart. This is it, says Rav Ashri. This is my chance to capture it before it's gone. And I realize there is a tremendous, exceptional Yotzi min haklal, line 23. Chomer hanosin lonu tmuna makifa al hachayim haruchaniyim, that gives you a full perspective on the spiritual life shel klui ha-ghetto, of those who are trapped in the ghetto. Al reka milchemes kiyum, on their struggle for existence. Line 24, yom yomi.
Every day.
This is the daily struggle to live. Says Rav Ashri, so I decided I'm going to collect them. Ulahatzev bahem, line 26. First words on the line. What am I going to propose? I'm going to give them a Yad Vashem. I'm going to give them a memorial. These shilas should live on. Zecher, next line. She'eris layados medinas lita. There should be a remembrance of the Lithuanian Jews that was so deep-rooted yeshivos, in its yeshivas, in its rabbonim, and its Torah giants. Now, last page, he says, look, I'm going to start with one book. You have 31 tshuvas here. And they're just a few of that which I have from that period. And please God, I'm going to, hopefully one day, you know, I'll publish more if I'm able to. And he does. He ends up being able to publish 5 volumes. In line number 10, he says, I thank God on the great kindness of God that he allowed me to stay alive and to survive. To line 12, Lazar Koach, to gather my strength, Lacharot Be'it Barzel V'Oferes. To Lacharot means not to write. It means to etch. To etch with an iron pen and with lead the horrors of that our people survived. And I want to now specifically call out, he says on line 15, these great yeshivas, you might mention, recognize some of the names. Lithuania yeshivas, Slobodka, by the way, replanted in Israel. Telz, replanted in Chicago and Cleveland. Ponovich, replanted in Israel. Kelm, Al Rosh Yeshiva Seyem, the Rosh Yeshivas, because that's where he was reared. He was reared intellectually in these yeshivas, in this milieu, with these rabbis. All those, so many of them, the vast, vast majority of these yeshivas, the Talmidim, the Rabbeim, the students and the teachers, all killed. And he says, I'm aware, and on line 19, interesting historical note, I'm aware it's possible shenaflu po v'sham here and there to oryos b'rishimas hakadoshim b'nagia legil. Maybe there are people who I'm going to mention here and their age is off. Maybe I wrote down the wrong age at the time. Tarich, maybe the date. Shkios miyavin v'ashem atov yechaper ba'adov. And then he thanks his shul for helping him to get to this point. That's what this is about. So in conclusion, we will now look at several of these tshuvas. We're not going to look at the answers. We're just going to look at the shailas. So we conclude with, this is just a couple. Simen Yud Zayin, here on page 8. What to do bedin chametz bepesach besocha ghetto? She'ela, here's the question. Befros chag pesach right before Pesach, nishalu begeto, kama she'elos, questions were asked. Kedas malas those kedelo lahachshel likashel beisr chamer achamer chametz achamer that you shouldn't violate the isra of chametz. So what do they do? So here are the questions. Number one, aleph imutar lechol kidneyos arbis. Can you eat arbis? What are arbis? Chickpeas. Black chickpeas that the Germans were distributing. Is that kosher to eat on Pesach? Number two, bays. There were people who were able during their slave labor to grab dirty potato skins. And they wanted to make little cakes of the dirty potato skins with the wheat, the flour that they had. Is this a problem that the potato skins are going to cause the wheat flour potentially to become chametz? Because usually when you make like matzah or Pesachtik cake, you don't put anything else in other than flour and water. When you eat Pesach cake today, you're using matzah meal. It's already been pre-baked. It can't become chametz any longer. So the question was, can they mix this potato stuff with wheat to make it into a cake? This is a question. Next question, Yud Chet. Also very difficult question. And this is the introduction to this question. He says, what's that? That one he didn't have a year on it. So I'm not sure, but this next one has a year on it. He says, She'ela, and listen how he writes the opening of this question. Kolu bidmos enai, my eyes cease from tears. Chamarmaru me'ai, my insides are disturbed. Al shever bas ami hagadol, on the brokenness of our people, and I cannot describe to you how they abused us, and they tortured us, etc. So it's a whole paragraph of wailing, of groaning. And then he gets to, you see the next paragraph, Vihine biyom chaf iyar shnas tuf shin beiz. So the 20th of iyar of 1942. So it's probably sometime in April or May. You could do hebkel.com and get the exact date. Pirsumu harishoim, the wicked ones, they promulgated an edict, Shem Yimtzu Isha Yehudis, if they find a Jewish woman, Kishihi Me'uberis, that she is pregnant, Yamisu Osa Yachar Im Ubaraha, they will instantly kill her with her fetus. Vinish Alti, and I was asked, Imutar L'Nishe Yisrael HaKluos B'Ghetto, for the women who were trapped in the ghetto, L'Shamesh B'Moch, to have intercourse using this legal language. Is called a moch. Literally, a moch is cloth. A cloth. It's a Talmudic term, which comes from the Gemara in Ksubis, where there's a lengthy discussion about contraception. They didn't have, you know, IUDs, and they didn't have, you know, pills. They had old-fashioned barrier methods. So the question was, are these permitted under the ghetto circumstances? Imutar l'neshei Yisrael kedei limnoa me'atzman es hayi rayon to prevent pregnancy, ulehi notzel al yedei kach misakanas nefashos. It's a Gemara, lengthy Gemara discussion in Yevamos. One more question, and this you remember. He has other issues here, Rachmano Litzlan, about suicide. He has issues about getting Christian papers. Can you present yourself as a Christian to save your life, or is that more like converting? So this question is a hair-raising question, and we've talked about it before, but I want to come back to it, especially for those who are new. Because this question cuts the core of, at least for me, the takeaway of the tshuvas, the responsa from the Holocaust, from the tshuvas Rav Ashri, is not just the legal precedent, the Jewish learning, and it's not just the historical context, but it's the mesiras nefesh, the emuna, the faith, and the faithfulness that people had to the Ribbono Shel Olam, to God, to halacha, to Torah, to mitzvos. So this is Simon Chavav. So he gives you the whole historical background. And this we'll see. Midarkam shel arotzchem ha'aruim yimach shemam. It was the way of the murderous cursed ones. Haya lohovil es hayehudim. It was to, lohovil means to drag or to push the Jews. I'm on page 10, last page. To drag the Jews. You have it there? Simon Chavav, 26. To drag the Jews, to push them, that they were coerced into slave labor. Be'ishon Laila, in the dark night. Lefnei alos ha'shachar, before sunlight. La'avod ha'sakfiya, for their slave labor. Kach, so such. They didn't have a chance to put on tefillin secretly before they would go to work. And what happened during the day? Did anybody get, in the slave labor in Lithuania, did they get a tefillin break? They get a tefillin break. Nobody got a tefillin break. They didn't get a tefillin break. The whole day, and they had back breaking labor until late at night. This is unbelievable. Vihine, second paragraph. Hayu, there were. Bein ovde akfia, among the slave laborers, ke'ela she'ozru oz, there were those who had such courage, lahaniach tfilin behechave, to secretly put on, to don the black boxes and the straps, as traditions from Moshe at Sinai, how they're supposed to look, going all the way back. Talk about Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebalpeh, to wear the tefillin while they're walking, while they're marching. Because think about it, it was dark, and there were lots of people, so you could secretly sneak donning tefillin while you're walking to your work detail. Kach. That's what it says. When? Takeif mishiheir hayom, just when it got light. Ulam, kara hamikre, third line of the second paragraph. Something happened. Shagermanim, the Germans, tafsu es echad me'ovdim kishu meniach tefillin be'isilucho. They grabbed one guy when he was walking while he's wearing the tefillin. Ula achar she'inu b'chol minei inuyim. After they abused him and tortured him with all terrible tortures, lo niskara daitam, their mind was not set at ease at shechartu, until they carved al yado asmolis into his left arm. The kiboris is the bicep. The bicep is where you put the tefillin. If you're right-handed, you put the tefillin on your left bicep. So this man was obviously right-handed. And they carved into his bicep, Shesi Ve'erev, a cross. Kach, so, She'i'ef sharhayolo legalos es yado l'shem anachas tefillin, that he could never don the tefillin without, when he pulled up the sleeve of whatever shmata, what would he see every time? He would see the cross that was carved into his muscle. Es os hakolon hazeh, this shame, shazedim o arurim chartu al besaro, that the wicked ones, the cursed ones, scratched into his flesh. Vinish alti. And what was the question? The question was, Imuterlo, if he's permitted, losim ritia al os kolon, that he could put a shmata, a band-aid, on top of the cross,
What is cologne?
Shame. This sign of shame, this mark of shame. Ulaniach tefillin al gabi aritia, and to put the tefillin on his sleeve. Kedei sheyachshivu haroim, so that people, when they see him wearing the tefillin, they should think he has a band-aid. Why? Probably because he got hurt. He has something wrong. But nobody shouldn't see that he has a cross on his arm. B'mokam anachas tefillin, ha'im yesh b'zeh, is there a problem of this, mishum chatzitza, of an interposition between the tefillin and the arm? The tefillin is supposed to be placed directly on the arm, or not? What's unbelievable about this tshuva, this shaila? Many unbelievable things. But to me, the most unbelievable thing about this tshuva is you have this poor Jew who was already moser nefesh to wear the tefillin in the first place. And then he gets caught and he gets beaten within an inch of his life. What does he want to do? He wants to keep putting on the tefillin. And the only thing that bothers him is that nobody should see that he has a cross on his arm. Because mamish b'chol nafshecha. B'chol nafshecha. Unbelievable. You learn from these shailos and tshuvas, from this work, just the most amazing emunah, the commitment, the mesiras nefesh. And we are the students of these shailos. We are the recipients of this mesiras nefesh. And we are the spiritual heirs of this legacy. What an unbelievable koach.